If you've ever had the privilege of traveling to England and have ever had the experience of renting a car, you know what a buzz it is. It is, of course, because they drive on the left hand of the road instead of the right. When you come to a corner and you turn left, you need to hug the curb rather than to go make a wide sweep. When you come to turn right, you need to make a wide sweep rather than hug the curb. It is totally counterintuitive, and you need to talk yourself into it at every juncture for a little while until you get it down. Now, Christianity is somewhat like that for us humans. That is much about what Jesus taught and what the Bible says about how to live is counterintuitive. It's the opposite of the way we think. We tend to think that the way to make sure we have enough in this life is to hoard everything we have. Jesus says, give, and it will be given to you. And so our passage today in Matthew chapter 16 is another one of those passages that is totally the opposite of the way we tend to think. It is counterintuitive. We're reading from Matthew 16, starting with verse 24. Jesus has just recently told his disciples, to their great chagrin, that he is going to go to Jerusalem, suffer many things at the hands of the leaders, and be put to death, and then rise again. Matthew 16, 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he has done. Here, Christ invites people to follow him by inviting them to suffer with him. Now, this is an unusual sales job. Most advertisements tout the benefits of what they want you to buy. You'll look better in our clothes. You'll feel better with our pills. You'll get more out of life in our vehicle. And so there are pictures of people. Have you ever seen an advertisement where everybody's not smiling, grinning ear to ear? New kitchen knives. Driving along the coastal highway in their new SUV. It's a little bit obnoxious, but that's the idea. And so it's so different here. Here, Christ entices people to follow him by offering them death. Moments ago, he said, I must suffer. Now he says to you, to follow me, you must suffer. He uses two phrases to describe this. He says, you must deny yourself and you must take up your cross. Let's think about them for a moment. Deny yourself, he says. In just 2 months from now, there's going to be Good Friday and then Easter. And for the 40 days before Easter every year, many Christians around the world celebrate that time. They call it the time of Lent, L-E-N-T. It is a time when a lot of people think about all that led up to the crucifixion of Jesus, and they try to be reverent and sober. And many people deny themselves something. Like they'll say, I won't eat chocolate for Lent. Have you ever heard that kind of phrase? This is particularly in denominations that have a little bit more high church, but Christians around the world, many of them do this. Jesus is not saying, when he says deny yourself, you must deny yourself chocolate. What he's saying is, you must deny yourself. To deny, the way the word is used throughout the New Testament, is usually about denying your relationship with a person. Do you remember when Jesus predicted to Peter, Peter, before the rooster crows three times, you will deny that you even know me. That's the idea here. Here, it means, when he says to deny yourself, it means to disown yourself as being your own master. To disavow yourself as being the most important person in life. To disavow that pleasing yourself is the most important thing to do. To deny yourself is to refuse for me to make pleasure my aim in life.
to make how I am wired and how I feel to be the guiding principle of my life. To be denying yourself is to make Christ's pleasure the aim of my life. And this is not just for super Christians, for missionaries, to really, really good Christians. Jesus said, if anyone wants to follow me, he must deny himself and come after me. He's speaking of all Christians. Now, the next phrase that he used kind of shows what some of it looks like to deny oneself. He says, if anyone would come after me, he must take up his cross and follow me. Now, Christ has just explained, as I say, I'm going to Jerusalem to die. Do you want to follow? You take up your cross. Now, anyone living in Palestine at the time, or really in any of the conquered countries of the Romans, knew that a prisoner condemned to execution by crucifixion is required to carry a portion of his cross. Usually he didn't carry the whole thing. He carried the crossbar, which is a massive weight, to his own place of execution. Jesus is saying that's what you must do if you were to follow me. Following me will involve your death. Now, doesn't this sound exactly the opposite of what we constantly hear in every media possible? Every media possible says, in fact, there's a sign if you go to Reading, if you go up 176 and then go on to Route 422 around Reading, there's a big sign. It just says, be yourself. That is the message to us from this world. The message from Jesus, if you want to be his, is die to yourself. These are striking words. So what does this taking up one's cross actually look like? It's easy to just be theoretical or abstract about these things. Well, we've said that it looks like death. I would say that he has in mind, for most of us, a series of deaths, plural, throughout life. Some of them are lesser, and some of these deaths are greater. Let's try to picture them, if we will. Lesser deaths that Christ has in mind when he says we must pick up a cross and die. He's talking there about putting faithfulness to him above my pleasure. He's talking about obeying Christ's commands when they are hard. Now, of course, he's talking about obeying Christ's commands when those commands say avoid sinful things. But also, he means dying to good things in this life, legitimate, natural things in this life, when being a disciple requires it. So let's take a few snapshots of what that might look like. To die, to pick up one's cross for Christ, has sometimes to do with who I spend time with. Each one of us, every one of us, have friends that are our go-to people, maybe family. This is the people we naturally gravitate to. Nothing wrong with that. But we also tend to have our go-from people. People that are invisible to us at best are people we somewhat avoid at worst. But what Jesus is saying is that people, particularly fellow Christians, whom you know could use your company, whom you know would be encouraged by some time with you, maybe, and with your friends and with your family, for you to ask them to join you. When you walk into the high school cafeteria, here are all your friends, and here is this kid who nobody sits with. To die and take up your cross is sometimes to sit with that kid or ask that kid to join you and your friends at this table. When I was in high school and college, I knew a girl who was extremely popular. Everybody loved going to her house, and we all hung out there. Some of my best friends, lifetime friends, I met there. And there, even though she was so popular and she would draw people, for instance, the guy who was the DJ for the top rock station in Baltimore City, he was over at the house all the time. This was the kind of people she drew. And yet, almost always at her house, there were one or two people who were really on the fringes. I'm thinking of a girl in particular who was extraordinarily plain. She was not lovely in any sense, and her personality was so withdrawn that it wasn't like a conversation with her was easy. But this girl who was a Christian, and who was so very popular, she drew people like that in. And when the other girl was in the room, she would draw that girl into the conversation And we all learned to draw that girl into the conversation because of watching our friend who was so popular. This is the kind of thing Jesus means when he says, pick up your cross and die, because it involves a little death to what you are naturally drawn to do. Another picture I think he has in mind when he talks about dying has to do with your privacy. I like being alone, you might say. I'm not drawn to being with people. I can relate to that. I had only one sister. She was 3 years older than I. Our interests were different. Our friends were different. And so I learned growing up to be alone a great deal. And I liked it. I loved it, as a matter of fact. And yet, I would say that being alone is often a primary form of selfishness. And what Jesus says is, I need to die if I'm a privacy addict by opening my life at times to others and interacting with them when I'd rather just be in focus. What does Jesus mean when he says, to follow me, you must pick up your cross and die? I think an example is it involves keeping your word when you promise something that turns out to be far more costly than you envisioned when you promised it. I'm thinking of a young couple in our church. There was a young couple in our church, is a young couple in our church, who needed to buy a car. And so they found a man who was willing to sell them his car, and they had a handshake agreement, yes, we'll buy your car. Immediately after that time, but before they had actually paid the money, another family in this church offered to give them a car. I can tell you, I saw it. It was a nice car. The young couple declined to take it because they had shaken hands with someone and say, we will buy your car. This is the kind of rubber meets the road thing that Jesus is talking about when he says, pick up your cross and die, because there was an unexpected cost to what they did. Just to give one more example, to die is to risk disapproval. It surely has struck you that crucifixion was not only the most painful death possible in that time, but it was the most disgraceful death. You were crucified naked. It was public. It wasn't getting your head chopped off in a dungeon somewhere hidden from public view. And so to die to yourself, part of what it means is to go public with your belief in Jesus, to not be ashamed to speak his name to other people whom you know could not care less about him and probably roll their eyes when they think about him. These are the kinds of things Jesus means when he says, deny ourselves and take up our cross. They are I'll call them lesser deaths that Jesus asks of us. But it's not just lesser deaths, particularly in other countries and maybe someday in our country. He's talking about greater deaths. Omar is a man who lives in Bangladesh, just next to India. Bangladesh is Muslim. Omar was Muslim. He had never met a Christian. He knew of no Christian churches. One day he's sitting in a park. A man came up to him, gave him a pamphlet. He read that pamphlet about Jesus Christ, and within no time, he believed. As he began to express this, his brothers and his parents became angry, and finally, they disowned him. You are not our child. You are not our brother. And they kicked him out of the house, and he had to live with friends. While he's living with a friend, he's working cleaning buses. And to his fellow cleaners and to the passengers of those buses, he would share the gospel. Many people listened, very few people believed. And he began to learn that following Jesus meant following a crucified Jesus. When he was talking to various people about the gospel, there was a fundamentalist Muslim who said, would you mind coming and sharing what you're sharing with a group of my friends and me? Yes, I will. And so he came. He brought his Bible, and he brought a copy of the Quran. And he showed how the Bible and the Quran gave totally different pictures of who Jesus Christ was. And he said that he believed in Jesus Christ. One of the Islamists in the group took the Quran from his hand, not the Bible, and tore it up onto the floor. He was shocked. He later learned why the man did that, because the next day the police showed at his door and arrested him for desecrating a Quran by tearing it up, which of course he did not do. When he explained what had really happened, the police disbelieved his story, and he was taken to a dark room, and for 4 days he was blindfolded and tortured. He was beaten with batons. His hands were tied behind his back to his ankles, and then he was hung upside down. He was given no water. It was horrific. Now, when he was taken to the hospital at the end of his time of torture, he was diagnosed as having fractured discs in his spine, which affected his walking for life. Some of the medications they gave him, I don't understand how this works, gave him permanent hair loss, and his case began to work its way through the legal system. He returned to the prison, and he was in prison for 14 months. There he was kept in a cell intended for 60 that housed 150 criminals. These were murderers and other felons. They all, when they slept, they had to lie on their side, all of them, in order to fit on the floor, side by side. He's the only Christian in the group. His Muslim inmates beat him, and they stole his food. But in the prison library, how could he do this in a Muslim country, found the New Testament and would read it with others whenever he could. 14 months later, he was released with one requirement. Every month, he must come and show himself to the police and to the courts. So he moves back into the village. When he's there, very soon, the 5 men who framed him in the first place met him on the street. They say, "We want to see your heart because you're a very bold man." And so they took their knives and they slit him open in the front. He was afraid to go to the hospital for fear they would poison him or they'd turn him in. So he treated himself. He eventually went to a Bible college, became a pastor, which he is now. He oversees 13 house churches, and he persecuted Christians. He has led about 150 people to Christ. And yet he is haunted because his family still calls him on the phone and insults him. He's in physical pain all the time, and his legal case is unsettled. He likely faces, as he goes every month, he doesn't know if they'll keep him. He likely faces 27 years in prison and possibly death by hanging. He has a wife and a 5-year-old daughter. His wife, by the way, supports his mission. She says that's his work, to share the gospel. And so he travels to new villages all the time to evangelize. Little deaths, large deaths. Who knows what God will require of anyone, but Jesus requires his disciples to be faithful to him, whether it costs this or that. The answer then to this is this, that not only can we not make pleasure our God instead of Jesus, but we can't make personal safety our God instead of Jesus, the primary aim of life. Of course, we try to be safe as we can, but we cannot make it the primary aim of life. Jesus said, "If anyone would come after me, let him pick up his cross and follow me." Well, if you're like me when you hear this, rather than totally being just energized to go out and do more, it can have the opposite effect. You may find it sobering. You may find it scary. You may think, I can think, I'm not sure I'm up to this. And so in our passage, Christ gives us some encouragement about it. Here's the encouragement he gives. He says that by my embracing Christ's cross and dying, I will find my life. By embracing Christ's cross, that's how I'll find my life. This seems like an invitation to self-destruction, but in reality, it's an invitation to real grandeur. He says, "You will find your life," and I take it he means both in this world and in the world to come. Let's think about that. You, as you die, little deaths, maybe one day a large one, in following Jesus, you will find your life in this world. One writer put it this way. He says, "The common belief is that the happiest person in the world is the one who possesses the most." But he says, really, the one who is happiest is the one who himself is possessed by Christ. And Christ gives that person some joys. Some of those joys are spiritual, and some of them are just secular and everyday. Spiritual joys, things like a clear conscience, which many people do not have. The joy of seeing yourself grow as a Christian, which does have an effect on someone to make their life glow a bit. The joy of finding your true self. As I said, our world tells us, be true to your authentic self. But in reality, that's being true to your inauthentic self. It's being true to your shallow alternative to who you were really made to be. You were made to be loved by God Himself and to love God in return and to experience this two-way love. And you were made to do so in ways that are unique to you. There are ways in which God wants to show you love and be loved by you that are different from the person next to you. That is why He made you. And as you take up His cross, you experience and you find out why you were made the way you are made. And thus you find yourself. This is life. You find your life by joy in worship, by joy in discovering things in the Bible you've never seen before, by the joy of serving other people, because as Jesus said, it's better to give. That is, it is more fulfilling to give than to receive. You find your life by having the pleasure of seeing God use you. And you find your life by finding yourself a person who has hope when the people around you look at the news and they just despair. But you know something good is coming when Jesus returns. And even the people who are persecuted find some joy and some life and find their own life in this life. Omar, the man from Bangladesh, said that when he was conscious during his 4 days of torture, he would pray. Here's how he said, it's quote, "When getting beaten and tortured, I felt more peace in God. I felt some of the pain that Jesus did when he died for us. And getting beaten was in that sense like a blessing to me. I was really happy about that." He who loses his life for my sake will find it in spiritual ways in this life. And yet some of the ways that you find life in this life from dying with Jesus are in non-spiritual ways. Large pleasures, not even just small pleasures. You gain a wife or a husband. You have a child who's born. You take a trip out west. Small surprises. A perfect day outside. The pleasure of friends. Maybe the pleasure of family. Maybe seeing a sunset, and you know, because you're a Christian, not only you know the Maker, but that He made it for you. So when you look at a sunset, you can experience it like a person walking into a room and hearing somebody turn on the lights and everybody saying, "Surprise!" And a surprise birthday party. Because when you see a sunset, like the person who walks into a surprise birthday party, you know that the decorations and the cake are not just for anybody, they're for you. And when you see a sunset, you can know it was made by God for you. This is the kind of joy that God intends to shower on people who die for His Son. That's the idea behind it. But we know that horrific things happen here on earth, and some of them are so hard, it might eclipse the joys we're talking about and make them seem small. The Bible is realistic. It talks about great pain that God may call you to. Maybe some things that feel like unbearable loss that some of you know, even as you sit here. In the book of Job, here's what Job experienced. He had his possessions destroyed, his fields were burned, his animals were killed, and his children were all killed at the same time in a terrible windstorm. Here's his words. "God has worn me out. I was at ease, and God broke me apart. He seized me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. He slashes open my kidneys and does not spare me. My spirit is broken." These are the words of one of the most famous believers in history. And that's why when Jesus promises you'll find your life if you follow Him, that though He is speaking in some ways of finding your life in this life, He is primarily speaking of finding your life in the world to come. The joy in this life that you will have from Him, those joys are not the main story. C.S. Lewis likens the life of a Christian to a long walk that a person had to take long before cars, perhaps. And he says, there may be some pleasant inns, I-N-N-S, there may be some pleasant inns along the way, but don't mistake them for home. Home is way down the road, and you are on the road. The idea, though, that Jesus is saying is that the joys and the sufferings of this life are short, but the joys of the next life are long. All Christians will be unspeakably happy in the next life. But some Christians will be happier than others because there will be degrees of glory depending on how each of us has carried his cross in this life. Here's that's why Jesus gives verse 27 in our passage. He says, the Son of Man, speaking of himself, the Son of Man is going to come from heaven. He's talking about the second coming. The Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he has done. That is, according to how each Christian or each non-Christian has taken up his cross. Now, please do not get the wrong idea. If you read the rest of the Bible, it's very clear. He does not mean that you can earn your salvation by suffering on his behalf. You cannot earn your salvation. Jesus' death for you is the only thing that earns your salvation. And if you're here and you're not yet a Christian, the first thing you need to do is to come to Christ's cross, not to suffer yourself, but to be grateful for his suffering for you and to believe in it and throw yourself on his mercy for his sacrifice. But even though you cannot earn your salvation by suffering for Christ, your suffering for Christ in ways small and large will evidence your salvation to the extent that you have died to yourself in this life, Christian. Your eternal joys will be greater. You will have the bliss of hearing Christ say to you in front of everyone who has ever lived, well done, you good and faithful servant. And so, Omar, who lives in Bangladesh, he keeps traveling to new villages, and he keeps sharing the gospel, knowing the possibility of what's in front of him. He says this, our life is temporary here. I only have a small amount of time to preach the gospel, so I don't believe that I will stop. Or this is the way C.S. Lewis had one of the characters in one of his books put it. And it's the words that Jesus would say to you through our passage. Die before you die. Die while you still live and have time to die on his behalf. So that's the positive side. You will find your life if you pick up your cross for Christ. But Jesus, I think primarily too, emphasizes a negative side here. And the negative side is this. It's a warning. By refusing Christ's cross, I will lose my life, Jesus says. By refusing to pick up my cross and follow him, I will lose my life. Christ's term for avoid carrying the cross is he who saves his life will lose it. A person who saves his life is a person who resists the notion that I must suffer or die in any way for Christ. And Jesus says in verse 25, whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Our great temptation, even for Christians, is to try to save our lives now. It's to try to live, quote, live my best life now, which everything in our culture screams to you to do. To save one's life is to live life mainly for your own self, for your ease, for your own comfort, for your fun, to seek popularity and prestige and success as your primary goals, to make financial success the big thing in life or make health the primary object, to see your earthly life as your greatest good. That's what it means when Jesus says those who try to save their lives are going to really lose out. And it could be a literal try to saving your life. That is to always avoid any kind of physical danger, even if it meant denying Christ to do it. He's saying that if we were to live in a country where they burst through the back doors right now in this service, they lined us up against the wall, and one by one they put a gun to your head and said, are you a follower of Jesus Christ or will you renounce him? Jesus says at that moment, you must not save your life or you will lose it eternally. To lose one's life begins in this world, but it ends in the next. Isaiah begins in this world when Jesus said, whoever loses life will lose it, because some people, not all, feel the loss of not being Christ right here in this life. They feel it because, well, a selfish person is usually a miserable person. Things can never be perfect enough. Life concocts endless disappointments. And so a person who's living for it now feels it slipping through their fingers like sand. You see this if you've ever walked through a casino. If you ever walk the length of a casino, and I hope if you do it, you do in order to see who's there and not to stay. If you ever walk the length of a casino, you will rarely, if ever, see anybody smiling like they do in the advertisements. You just see one dead, bland face after another. It's a staggering. I've never seen so many dead-looking people in my life gathered in one place as in a casino. That's the idea. They're trying to save their lives, and they're losing it. But Christ is mainly not talking about losing your life in this life. He's mainly talking about losing your life in the next life by refusing his cross in this life. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, he says. And it is mysterious to me why almost all English translations, almost all, I was only able to check a few, but the few that were readily at hand this week, translated, whoever wants to save his life will lose it. It's much stronger than that. He says, whoever wants to save his life will destroy his life. That's exactly what he said. The reason is that you can't make this earthly life last forever. And so to focus on it as the highest good, by that very act, you will forfeit life in heaven. That's what he's saying. Jesus says, verse 26, what good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world and yet forfeits his soul? That word gain is a business term. What gain, what profit will it be to gain the whole world and lose your own soul? That is, if you could gain all the world could offer, if you could enjoy athletic success and intellectual achievements, if you could have the house you want, the school you want, the marriage you want, if you could have the career that you crave, the money you deserve, if you could have the prestige and the friends and the fame that you wish, if you could have the peace of being left alone by everybody for the rest of your lives to make happiness your primary aim, is the one way to be sure to lose all your happiness forever. What good, Jesus says, would it be to lose one's own soul at the end of it? Or as Luke puts it, to lose one's very self. Lose is a business term here. Here it means you'll be ruined. You just be here a few years and then die and then go to eternal misery. Here's what Plummer said. What worth are possessions once the possessor perishes? A.A. Alexander put it this way. What are enjoyments once there is no one to enjoy them? If the man himself is lost. And Jesus ends this little passage in verse 27 by pressing this point poignantly. He says, what can a man give? I'm sorry, verse 27. What can a man give in exchange for his soul? The idea is this. He's picturing a man at the final judgment. The man realizes, oh no, I have lost my life forever. And then his mind scrambles at what kind of bargain, what kind of deal can he make? What kind of last minute exchange can he give to buy back his soul? And Jesus says, if you had the whole world, you could not buy back your soul. Your soul is of infinite value. The world is just a finite value. If you could get it all, and nobody can get it all. What can someone pay to get his life back after a lifetime of stuffing himself with his own pleasure? There is nothing he can pay. When will this dreadful event happen to those who are not willing to pick up a cross and follow Jesus and die in this life? Well, their physical death is a foretaste of what will happen, but the real event will happen at the second coming of Jesus. Here's what he says in verse 27. For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he has done. Jesus pictured the day when all the earth, present, future, and past, are gathered before him. And then he is this magnificent being that will come in the sky, attended by angels as a sign of his power and a sign of his majesty, and attended by angels because he himself has predicted that angels will gather his believers from the four corners of the earth. But he also says that the angels will gather those who have lived for themselves. He says it this in Matthew 13:41. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his garden all who do evil. Imagine at the end of time, angels going through all humanity who have ever lived, and they pick the people who have refused to in any way pick up a cross of Christ and suffer with him as his disciple. And they will be considered as weeds to be taken out from the valuable crop and put over here and forced to stand before Christ's throne. He says, and then the Son of Man will reward each one according to what he has done. Those who are Christ's, of course, will be covered by the blood of Jesus. And then the amount of their happiness will be according to how they have lived. And those who are not Christ's will just get straight one-for-one justice. They will be rewarded according to what they have done. If I have spent my life, quote, saving my life, I will forfeit my soul, and I will be conscious of it eternally in hell. Jesus says to you this day, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and pick up his cross and follow me. Shall we bow our heads and think about that?
And now for the benediction. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Spirit be with you all. Amen. God bless you.